You're listening to a recorded talk from Greenbelt Festival.
It gives me great delight as we continue thinking and exploring. John Philip Newell yesterday morning encouraged us to open ourselves and our minds. And I have no doubt that our speaker and speakers this afternoon are going to help us to do that. Lamorna Ashe's new book, A New Generation Search, is so timely with the publication of the Bible Society's Quiet Revival statistics at the moment. And Lamorna brings her journalistic expertise and skill together with a beautiful prose style to explore in her book what those in their 20s experiences as she journeys across the UK. And she's going to be in conversation with Azariah France Williams, who is not a newbie at Greenbelt. It's been great to have had him with us before. A friend of Greenbelt, a priest and an author, and Ghost Ship, Institutional Racism in the Church of England is maybe one that you've dipped into or certainly heard of. Greenbelt Pagoda, we invite and welcome two exceptional speakers this afternoon. And we continue to think what it means to search for meaning and live as people of faith today. So at the end, the middle of this afternoon, relax, lean in, lean back, and be inspired and encouraged. Lamorna Ashe and Azariah France Williams.
Thank you.
What an absolute joy and pleasure it is for us to be with you here in Pagoda. So while I've been sitting here for the last few minutes, every so often Lamorna goes, waves to somebody. So if you want to wave at Lamorna, wave at Lamorna now. Come on. Yeah, get all your waves out. Get all your waves out. Brilliant. That is beautiful. So put your hand up. Everyone, just put your hand up. Put your hand up. Now keep your hand up if you're intending to buy this book. So
that's hard to look at. Come on.
It is a great book. It is beautifully written. It is an amazing guide. I've listened to it on an audiobook version, yourself reading it, and it's just incredible. Really inspiring. Even as we were sitting here, people were coming up and saying, thank you, your book is amazing. My 21-year-old's had it. So it's intergenerational, interdimensional, because you talk about cosmic stuff. It's like, it's just fantastic. It's brilliant. Okay, put your hand up again. No. So when I am at my church, which is in Manchester, we start our services by saying, share your name with your neighbour. Because we're all here to meet one another as well. And so in a moment, I'm going to ask you to share a name with a neighbor. Now I say a name, it doesn't have to be your name. So perhaps you might like to choose a name. And while you're having a little think about that, my question to you, Lamorna, is that in your book, you talk about Jacob wrestling with the angel and how Jacob becomes Israel after this conversion. You talk about Saul of Tarsus, who becomes Paul. And I wonder, while they're greeting each other, if you could think about, with the process that you've been through, could you choose a conversion name? Or perhaps you already have one. And what might that be? A name alongside yours to mark the changes that you've been going through. So, over to you. Share a name with a neighbour and say hello and, you know. Okay. If I could have your attention, please. There's a lovely buzz here. There's a great energy here. It's brilliant. So I'd like you again for another 30 seconds to share with your neighbour, the group you're talking with, if there's a question that you've arrived with. Towards the end of this session, we're going to have some time. Lamorna said, I want the toughest, most trickiest, theological, philosophical questions that they can come up with that I can bat back, you know? Because in the book, you said, you know, when I started this, I wasn't a theologian or a philosopher, but I dare say you are now.
No, but I'm excited to try.
I dare say you are now. Do you agree with me? Yes, absolutely. And so, so I'd like you to have another quick chat. If you have a question that you've arrived with, something from the book, something from what you've experienced of Lamorna's journey, and later on we'll be able to pull some of those questions and have a conversation about them too. So go back in, and then when we come back out again, we're going to hear Lamorna's conversion then. Wonderful. Okay, if we can... Right, we're going to continue now. So Lamorna, I wonder, could you tell us, is there another name that you might choose? And if so, what would it be?
Well, what I really liked when I was looking at these conversion stories, which is how I begin my book in this introduction, I really like that within the Old Testament, within Genesis, Jacob still gets called Jacob alongside Israel. Paul is described as Paul, who was also Saul. So I have this sense, I think the older I get, the stranger my relationship with time is, and the more I feel that it's important to hold multiple selves together through time. So I also in the book, it's a very uncertain journey, the one that I go on alongside all the people I meet and interview about their conversion stories. And I have not come to anything definitive. And in fact, the further I get from writing the book, the less definitive it all feels to me. So unfortunately, I'm not ready to give you a conversion name. But when I get to one, the hope is that I would hold them simultaneously if I get to one. I quite like the fact that the name Lamorna, which means valley with a river running through it in Cornish, it has a kind of doubly feeling of both land and water. So maybe holds multiple things in it. I'm cheating, I'm sorry.
That's wonderful. Thank you very much. Now that's beautiful. That leads me perfectly onto a prayer I'd like to say at the beginning of this. So someone who's on the field last year is Cole Arthur Riley. Don't know if any of you have come across this book, Black Liturgies. And she writes a prayer about the fluidity of God. And you just reminded me. So if we can still ourselves. Fluid God. Now then, my contact lenses do not allow me to read this. So I wonder, might you?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Thank you. Okay. Thank you very much.
Okay. Fluid God. Fear can make us demand definition from mystery. We tell stories about your static nature to make the divine digestible to us. We condense and simplify our own stories to make them clear and resolved. Since we were little, we've been dissected not with nuance and complexity, but by a zeitgeist that favors categories and binaries. It feels like we must choose to be smart or pretty, to be angry or kind, to be masculine or feminine, to be well or wounded. Free us from this confinement. Help us to remember we are not singular, that we are free to be more than one thing. Protect us from a world intent on narrowing our selfhoods. Remind us that these binaries exist not so that we might be understood, but so that we might be made small. Guide us as we honor the sacred spectrums within each of us and within one another. There is a multitude in us. We will not be reduced.
Great.
Thank you. Beautiful poem.
Thank you very much. Thank you. So I need three volunteers, please, who can come. Oh, wonderful. Yes. Thank you. Please come and join. Here. Oh, there's someone at the back there. Yeah. If you want to come on up. Brilliant. Yeah, just stand there. Perfect.
Mark.
Hi, Mark. Good to meet you. Brilliant. And then it's a person here. Wonderful. Then one more person.
I am aware this is going to be the most surreal interview I think I've ever had. It's already creeping out. <already. laughs>
Wonderful. Thank you. What's your name?
I'm Sam.
Hi, Sam. Sam, this is Mark. Mark, this is Sam. Right. And one more person. Oh, yeah. Wonderful. Yes, please. Yeah. Come on. Excellent. Oh. Come on up. Come on up. Brilliant. Thank you very much. I like the way the room said, no, no. It's brilliant. The room has spoken. What's your name?
I'm Anna.
Hi, Anna. Lovely to meet you. Sam and Mark. So, Sam and Mark, I'd like you both to stand up and pretend, freeze frame, you're a comedy duo. Beautiful. Yeah, freeze frame. Yeah, yeah. Lovely. Okay. So as I understand it, Lamorna, in the book, one of the things that sparked the interest was some friends of yours that were a comedy duo decided to become priests. And so now I'd like you to freeze frame priests. And Anna, I wonder, could you freeze frame Lamorna thinking, ah, this is a good idea? Brilliant. So, Lamorna, could you tell us a little bit more about this story? Stay in your freeze frame, please.
Well, I think they've done justice. It's hard to know what more needs to be said. A picture speaks a thousand words. So my background is in anthropology, much like Mark, I believe, who's up there in the freeze frame, because I saw him do a really good talk yesterday. I was looking for a new thing to write about. My first book was about the Cornish fishing industry. And I have that thing when you're a journalist, and I think lots of you guys are writers or creatives, where you're looking for something that has this spark in it that makes you want to know more. And yeah, I heard this story that was just two people I'd known from university who were a comedy double act, and they both converted to Christianity and both decided to become priests. And I have no background in religion whatsoever. And to me, so that just felt like, to be honest, a good story, almost a good bit of gossip. And so I pitched it to The Guardian, do this thing called a Guardian long read. And it's 6,000 words, which actually allows you as a journalist, like the meat and the time to really sit with ideas. And what I found when I first started interviewing these people about their conversions was I didn't have the framework or the language to even know how to ask people what it meant to become Christians. So I'd say, do you guys believe in the resurrection? And they'd say yes. And I'd go, oh, that doesn't really help. I don't know. How do I turn that into a proper article? And what I realized very quickly was that I had to go to church alongside them, that I had to be in the spaces in which their faith was made manifest. And the more time I spent with them in church, I started to realize, and I interviewed these guys for like a year and a half, I could see the way that their faith was shifting them, was transforming their lives in small ways and larger ways, in the relationships they had, in the way they thought about the world, the future. And so I then went to my publishers and I was like, I think this is a huge story that I knew nothing about. If there's a few people converting doing this, then there must be so many others as well. And so then I did that expression for like 2 years, walking around London and England and trying to interview lots of people about their conversion experiences.
That is wonderful. Thank you. Now, the book is wonderful, but I'd love to know a little bit about you and maybe like your childhood, your curiosity, you know. And so what we have, I wonder if the three of you could wander over here and...
Wander?
Yes, wander over here. Nice. And the floor, we have a number of objects. I wonder if you could take it in turns and lift up the objects that are in front of you. Not that one, these ones. Okay. So we have a phone. Okay. What do you have there, Anna? Okay. Yes, a dragon. Some binoculars. Beautiful. You have a unicorn there. What else is there? Yes, a baby's dummy. Wonderful. Yeah. It's a big baby. A mask, boxing glove, Jesus. Amen. Brilliant. We have a bag. Very nice. And also we have we've got the space hat there, the mask, and then there's another mask as well, isn't there? There we go, Mark. Brilliant. We've got a chicken head there too. Okay.
So not glove.
Beautiful. So Lamorna, I wonder, could you choose three objects from here that tell us a little bit about a bit about you? And while you're having a think, have another chat in your groups and think which object describes you. Okay. Brilliant. So, Lamorne, it'd be lovely. Yeah, can you choose a couple of these objects that might tell us a little bit about younger Lamorne?
It's really hard. I'm definitely more of a wordy person than a visual person, so I find this quite challenging. I suppose maybe the lovely, is it a spaceship on your head there, or is it just an astronaut outfit? I think definitely I was a bit of a kind of cosmonauty, dreamery kid. So maybe that, I always talk about, people always talk about where you get the desire to write from. And I always think my mum was the most imaginative person. And every day on the way to school, she would make me pretend that every person that I met was some kind of figure in this like continuing narrative that we'd make up. So there was someone that was a spy and someone was, I can't remember what else, like maybe like a secret cyborg. And I feel like she instilled in me this desire or this ability to see everything as possibly creative. So maybe I would take the astronaut helmet. I loved chickens as a child. I went and saw Beans on Toast early and he had a really good song about chickens. And he's wicked. I'm glad you saw him. I had an uncle who had chickens and I used to follow those chickens around a bit. So I guess that, I wouldn't say it defines me as a child, but it's relevant. And what else? I mean, the telephone is, it's a feel. I suppose I didn't really get a phone until secondary school, but then I guess like so many young people that became this like vital lifeline of how you stay in contact with friends and it felt very important. And also all the darkness of social media coming in at the same time. So maybe it was one that I wouldn't want to define me, but definitely, I suppose, was part of my childhood. I'm not really sure. I'll take those three.
Yeah, that's wonderful. Thank you so much. Can we give a round of applause to Anna, to Sam and to Mark? As we place the object down and have a seat. That's beautiful. Thank you so much, guys.
Thank you.
See, budding careers here. So what I love about the book is that it feels like a real travel guide through different versions of Christianity. I'd love to hear you maybe choose four or five of the different contexts that you explored. And also in that, I'd love to hear you say something about some of the points when you realised you were moving from being a narrator of the story to becoming a native within it.
I think because my background's anthropology, I was always taught this importance of subjectivity, like constantly you're asked a question, how are you reshaping the space that you're in? So I think the way that I've written has always been this sense of, it's the observer effect that you talk about within physics, that you are changing the environment by being there. So I think I kind of always knew I'd be a character within it, possibly not to the extent that I was, but I knew that I couldn't go on this message, adventure of finding people seeking faith if I wasn't at least willing to be thinking about it in my own life. I think this thing of once you start trying to learn in the belief or learn how to believe in other people's belief, it requires a kind of shift in you. So my adventure, so I had this wicked, really old Toyota Corolla that has now died, RIP, my beautiful Toyota Corolla 2001. But I would go off and I would book all these different places that I would go and stay in. And I think to begin with, again, imagining you guys, if you didn't have this real understanding or deep understanding of Christianity, where to begin with, I barely knew the difference between conservative, evangelical, all the way over to Orthodox. Like I wasn't really sure of the kind of the roadmap of each of these places. So I just booked things, or a friend would say to me, I've got a friend of a friend who's got a friend who's a Christian. I'd be like, can I have their number? And then I just turn up in these places. I'm not a very organized journalist, it must be said, but I quite like the chaos of then you try and find the structure afterwards. And I have this deterministic sense that there is this structure that you have to discover within your writing. So to begin with, I split the book into three parts. And the first part, I was looking at more conservative expressions of faith. And so one place I went to was Youth with a Mission. Have people heard of YWAM? Yeah, I thought most of you would have. So I went to Youth with a Mission in Harpenden. And as I was writing this book, you know, your normal bits of your life are happening. Things are difficult. You're going through things. And I found the motion really challenging to begin with, where I'm in my own life and then I'm off in Youth with a Mission. And when I was there, I interviewed people who were wonderful. And I particularly spent time with this great couple. But then I would watch their form of faith, and it was so alien to me, who, you know, has only been to like Anglican churches a bit growing up on Christmas, to see this form of faith where it was a really Pentecostal worship, people were speaking in tongues. someone prayed for me. They said if I've got any pain, could they try and pray away my pain? I'd never done anything like this. And I said, well, I have got a recessive gum that's really painful. And so this person stood and he tried to pray for my tooth pain to take it away. And then he asked if it was any better. And I said no. And I always think if I'd said yes, it would have changed the whole adventure of it. It'd been like, wow, it would really have shifted. I mean, there were so many miraculous encounters that I heard about in the book, but definitely less so that I experienced myself at the start. So when I left Youth of the Mission, I'd done a Bible studies workshop at Christianity Explored, which is kind of equivalent to Alpha course. And I found it challenging. I found it so exciting to read Mark's gospel for the first time, to be given the tools to like wrestle with scripture, to see that there was all this room for play finding your own way through it. But at the same time, I was being told that you had to read it rigidly. No one alongside me was reading it rigidly, but the person at the front was saying that you did have to read it in this particular way. He also immediately started talking about, in our first session, this is Mark Gospel, verse 1, he was saying, he loves gay people, but they should never sleep with one another. They have to remain celibate. And I thought, this is the first session of Christianity Explored. What are you doing? So I think immediately, though, I was challenged and confronted in these spaces. And I thought, this is the reason none of my friends are Christian at all. And part of writing this book was that when I'd been interviewing these two guys, these two comedians who you saw on the stage, that I had this sense that already I was seeing a form of Christianity that was very different to what my friends had assumed it was, which was just a conservative form. And I was desperate to therefore go out and meet these kinds of people who are different from this loudest denomination, the kind of American style conservative evangelical form of Christianity. And a Christian person, I think actually someone in the audience, had said to me, why don't you go to some Christian retreats? Because that is a way in which you can start questioning what this could be like in your own life. And maybe you just need that space and that quiet. So I set off on these three retreats. I went to Iona, and it was, I think that was the first time I cried in every single service on that island, and heard the wild geese fly overhead and the wind coming through, and the John Bell's simple, beautiful hymns. And I just was so moved. It cut right through me. It was like an escape valve, you know, all these things being released from me. And then I'd come back to London and be like, what was that? And we'd go back into my life. And then I went to Walsingham, which is the one place where the Virgin Mary is touched down in Britain, I think the 14th century. And when I was in Walsingham, I was spending time with these nuns, and I was meeting nuns who were my age. And one of these young nuns said to me in one of our interviews, I asked her why she'd become a nun, and she said, because I don't want to miss my life. And each time I'd have people say things like that, it would completely disturb or break down my sense of what a person of faith or a person who ends up in a convent would be like. Because I thought that you became a nun to miss your life. And I thought what I was doing was trying to lead a rich life where I did everything. And she was saying that there's something about then choosing to give your life to God in that way that means she can be present. She can be so there for other people. She can pray for the world. She can consider others. She can have this sort of spiritual, expansive life. And then I came back from Walsingham and I said to my friends, do you think I should become celibate? And they were like, I don't think that's it, but I don't know. And then I went off to a Jesuit retreat, St. Bino's in North Wales. And I went on a Gerard Manley Hopkins Jesuit retreat. And Gerard Manley Hopkins is, someone told me something really that I really like about conversions, that it's not, people talk about momentary instant conversions, but actually there's always a lead up to those as well. There's all the material in your life that precedes that, that gets you to that point. And Gerard Manley Hopkins was this poet through whom I saw that faith was meant to be a wrestle, that would be this beautiful, expansive, euphoric thing. He's a Victorian poet, but he feels deeply contemporary, but also challenging and dark and difficult. And I loved his poetry because it felt so true and so real and so about this struggle for meaning. So I went on this Gerard Manley Hopkins retreat, and I got there and I turned up and I was telling the person who was running the retreat, I was like, I love Gerard Manley Hopkins. I'm so excited to be here. And then she turned to me and she went, you know, this is a silent retreat, don't you? And I was like, I never read the fine print. And I was like, yes, of course. And then I had 6 days of silence with Gerard Manley Hopkins and the spiritual exercises of Ignatius Loyola, which are these beautiful ways of imagining yourself into the life of Christ, into the life of the Gospels. And after those big three retreats, it was like, I just had a bit more infrastructure or scaffolding with which to explore faith more deeply. And then the rest of the book, I think I felt so much more capable of then going and meeting people. I met loads of Quakers. I met people who deconstructed their faith. I met mystics. I met trans Catholic people who, in his church, he passes a man. No one knows that he's trans. And he has this like beautiful relationship with his faith. I went to, I think lots of them at least are at Greenbelt, a really queer affirming church in Brighton. I went on loads of marches with Quakers. I found this beautiful church, this St. Luke's West Holloway. And I think if I hadn't gone on those retreats and sort of had this sense of going away in order to come back, I then wouldn't have been ready otherwise to meet these people who had all these completely discrete and diverse and dissimilar and fascinating forms of faith.
That's incredible. Wow.
Says Ben.
I wonder, your friendship community, as you sort of been around visiting these different places, what was their kind of perspective? Were they sort of supportive, skeptical? What was going on and what are they thinking and feeling now?
Yeah, they were skeptical. I think because, again, they have this sense of, and I'm sure loads of you feel this, that from the outside, it feels like Christianity, it's often so allied, it looks like it's so allied with homophobia, also its colonial history is writ so large over it. That I think my friends thought, why would you join? You know, you already have to be British and therefore all the like horrible baggage that comes with being British. Why would you also ally yourself with the Christian church? Are you kidding? You don't have to. And they don't do that with other religions. My friends are such bright, thoughtful people, but they were very particular on their ideas about Christianity. And I think to begin with, I'd always frame as a bit of a joke. I'd like leave parties early because I was like, I've actually got to go to church tomorrow because I'm interviewing someone there. And it is frustrating. Suddenly all my work was on Sunday mornings, which was really not conducive to my lifestyle. Still isn't. Not that much of a party as I'm getting older. Maybe I like to say that more than I mean it. Then my friends, at one point, they were like, can we still take the piss out of you about this whole Christianity thing? And I was like, oh, I think it's important. You always feel you can take the piss out of me for most things I do. Please, please continue to do that. But I think definitely they found it strange. I went on a date with someone and she was out at a club with some of her friends. And they were like, how can she date you? She's a Christian. And the person was like, oh, yeah, I haven't actually asked her. I'm not sure. It seems to be fine. And so these funny things where I was like, oh, I haven't had these difficulties before of having to identify or having to explain that it's much more nuanced than that. The beauty of getting to be a writer is sometimes I find it, particularly with close friends, it's hard to articulate what's actually going on for me. But then I can give them this book and be like, hey, this is what happened, by the way, the last few years. And they've been absolutely amazing about it because I think you can see that the book is in no... I think the thing I like most about myself as a writer is that I try and hold uncertainty on the page because I'm someone who seems to sit happily in ambiguity. And I don't ever come to consistent, coherent positions. I seem to oscillate all over the place. And writing is amazing because you can try and hold that, all those tensions in the page. And so hopefully they've got to see the form of faith in which I've ended up in that way. They definitely, none of them wanted to come to Greenbelt. They definitely won't ever come to church with me. But yeah, sometimes they'll come to the Quaker block with me in Palestine protests and things. So they've been curious and surprising and they're wonderful. So they're definitely really open to it. I think it was more that they had this one particular form of Christianity that they assumed was the only one.
Well, so something I know, because I've heard you speak about it before, Lamorna, is that you are not homophobic because... Tell me about the title of the book.
Oh, God. Now, did you get that? It was homophobic. Because the title of the book is a line from The Simpsons. We can go home now. Perfect. We'll go Homer. So titles are really, really hard. I'm sure everyone knows this. I think it's kind of like, it's not the same as using the name for a child. Obviously, a child, it's a more important thing than a book. Perhaps for you, maybe. For me, maybe. Yeah. But that... It's this line, this Simpsons episode I love called When Maggie Makes Three. And it's a flashback episode and it's absolutely beautiful. And it ends up with Homer Simpson. He'd got a perfect job working in a bowling alley, which was his dream. He left the power plant, therefore said goodbye to this form of capitalism in which he hated, this like extractive capitalism. And then unfortunately, Marge got pregnant again with Maggie, and he has to go back to the power plant because once again, they're going to be in debt. And when they get to the power plant, Mr. Burns says to Smithers, well, it's customary, we have to give him the plague. And Smithers goes, no, a plaque. We give him the plaque. And they put up this big plaque that says, don't forget you're here forever. And it's obviously vile. And yet again, this sense of like, you are going to be in this job for the rest of your life. And what Homer does...
This is what the people are thinking now as well. My goodness, we're going to be here forever. No, you're not. It's all right.
So Homer then papers over this sign with loads of pictures of baby Maggie. So instead it reads, do it for her. It's just beautiful, isn't it? It's just a really lovely thing. And I think there's loads of ways you can play with the title. But for me, it was this, I guess the idea of forever is a really interesting one within Christianity, thinking about heaven, thinking about afterlife, thinking about whether this religion will persist through time, thinking about whether all religions eventually fade and become obsolete. But also this idea of if you reading the Gospels for the first time, realizing how people they are, that ultimately it is people saying, follow me. It is saying, love your neighbor, that actually do it for her. This idea of we're doing this for one another, we're seeing God in one another, felt like a really beautiful thing. So it's a title that then hopefully has a kind of hyperlink that you can kind of go all over the place with.
That's wonderful. What a great title. Thank you. So it's going to be back over to you now. So what I'd like you to do in your little groups with your neighbors is to choose the question that you would like to represent within your group. And so, you've all maybe shared the question that you came with. Now I'd like you to choose one out of that. So have a quick conversation, and out of those questions that you've been generating, choose one and let the others. Okay, right. So can you put your hand up if you've now got one question from the larger group? Okay, brilliant. Now then, earlier on, when we had Mark and then we had Sam, and then I was about to get this young person over here to come up, and the room said, no, we would like this lovely lady, Anna, to come up instead. And so I want to ask us to think about which of the questions and who will come and bring a question. And then in the next minute or so, I'm going to invite the questions that are chosen and think about the questioners. So think, you know what? It's about taking and making space. If you're someone who is used to taking space and asking questions, perhaps you might like to make space and let somebody else come to the fore. Maybe you're someone who is used to holding back because sometimes you can't get a word in. I want to encourage you to think about, well, maybe I might take space. And so I'm going to give you just another 20 seconds to choose who your questioner will be. And then we're going to, what I'd like you to do is to come up to this microphone, and we'll take a number of questions. We won't get through all of them, but we'll take as many as we can. Okay, does that sound okay? So have a conversation, find the questioner, find the question.
Friends, as Azariah has asked, it's also our practice here in the Pagoda to allow all voices to be heard as best we can. So we recognise that you might have someone in your group who actually needs to have the roaming mic brought to them because coming down to the front is not as easy. So please do signal to us if that is the case, and Sophie will come to you to make sure that we can make that possible for you.
Brilliant. Thank you very much. Okay, so we have a number of people who have gathered here at the mic, and we're looking out. Look at this, so many people would love to ask questions. All right, so if I can ask if you can keep your questions short and to the point. Brilliant. Please come up, introduce yourself and ask your question, Before you do so, if I can have a respectful hush, please, within the room, and over to you.
Hello, my name's Liddy. I work for a Christian charity, so I've read quite a bit about the Quiet Revival, and you're the only person who I've heard write about it with any kind of nuance. And so I wonder, how do you kind of reconcile the fact that large numbers of young people coming to faith is a wonderful thing, and that the young people coming to faith are largely men and largely attending and coming to faith in places that teach the subjugation of women? And how do you kind of like reconcile that with each other?
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
All the men sit down.
That's powerful. I guess it was funny because I started writing this book before that research was coming out. I've lost where you are now. There you are. For me, it was just this hunch about, oh, it's just interesting that there must be more to Christianity, more going on here than the stats say. And I suppose that was what I found really joyful about this research is statistics are really hard. Like, that particular survey was quite small. It was very particular. It was done by a Christian group. There's so much to do with like bias that plays into this that makes it really challenging to know how truthful that is. Also with statistics, you don't know what the mechanics of that person's faith are, the intricacies, the delicacies of it. You don't know how long they're going to stay Christian. You don't know if they've just gone to church for a week and then they're going to stop afterwards. So for me, the point of doing the kind of research I do is that you get to go alongside people just for that bit longer, to have these longer conversations. So sure, you can then say I interviewed 60 people, but hopefully none of them feel like statistics in the books. They're interviews that I listen back to multiple times. So I get to really check, like, what were they saying there? I get to call up people and see them again. I've called people since and loads of their faith has changed or they've changed denomination since then. So statistics gives this very strange two-dimensional static portrait. I suppose that I think it's interesting. I feel like we talk a lot about our worries about young men a lot more than we talk about women. It's always, oh no, what's happened to the young men? Perhaps because it's a very patriarchal society and we're ultimately more concerned about men. But I think that it is interesting that there's groups of young men who are going to maybe like orthodoxy or more conservative forms of Christianity or more conservative forms of Catholicism or Anglo-Catholicism. Or and are looking for maybe like certainty and order and perhaps, yeah, a space in which you can feel safe within a kind of patriarchal structure and you're told very particular rules about sex or about sexuality. That is one portrait. We also don't know perhaps what those men are gaining might also be really beautiful and they are opened up to spiritual spaces and that might be the beginning of their journey and their lines might change. Yeah. I also know at the same time that I met so many people, so many young people who are drawn to more radical forms of faith, who become Quakers because they're like the Quakers, the only people who've called what's happening in Gaza a genocide. They're the first people that said that gay people should be able to be married within the Quaker meeting houses. There's no way of defining what Gen Z is or what my, you know, millennials are. There is this huge variety of kinds of people, just as the church that is Christianity is this massive wide church. So I think that always the answer is go under the statistics and go ask questions and stick around with people and see what they're actually thinking.
Great, thank you. Brilliant.
Hi, I'm Shanti. I finished reading your book a couple of weeks ago and I really, really enjoyed it. I also found it really difficult to read at points. I think I've been brought up in a very conservative church and have spent quite a few years being very angry. And I think seeing you be able to kind of just see what church was like without being in it as much, like, I think that's a great thing that you're able to do, but I found it quite hard. And I was just wondering what you found hard or what made you angry in your experiences of all the different types of churches.
Thank you. That's a really great question. Yeah, I had this complete lucky naivety in that I got to come into churches in my mid-20s, having already worked out quite a lot about what I thought my identity is, what my morality is, the things that I am fixed upon, the things that I am more able to be fluid about. And that made it a much safer experience for me because I could go into spaces that said, we believe that if you're gay, you shouldn't have sex. And I could be like, that means nothing. You know, that's ridiculous. I know that's ridiculous through experience. And I could then I think what made me angry was that I met so many people who had grown up maybe in churches like you did, and it wasn't an anger, I write this in the book, that was mine by right, but I could feel in those spaces this sense of, if you're being told these very rigid positions about certain things from a very young age, and there's sort of spiritual abuses at play, that is really difficult. And I met so many people, in fact, one of my friends, he was like, I started reading it and I was like, I just can't read this book, because he was brought up in a very conservative church. He lost his faith entirely at university. He stopped being able to sleep because he would pray to go to sleep. And he was like, I can't actually, this sense of like life contracting down to the earthly realm, whereas before he had a sense of heaven, he had a community. And I think that it can be so painful. People cannot recover from that stuff, or can say, I never want to go into a church space again, which I completely understand. I think that's so right. And I think, yeah, so I was in this very particular position of being slightly wide-eyed about this stuff. The things that made me angry, though, was the only person I'm sort of angry with in the book is this one evangelical priest who has, like, a lot of power, and he's really been trying to push the Church of England to keep against any widening ideas about sexuality, to keep preventing it from being possible for queer people to marry within the church, who has a really transphobic narrative as well. And I just felt he had so much power, and there was so much anger in him that I wanted to put that into the writing. Whereas most people I met were not powerful people in the church. They were young people converting to faith, changing their views on certain things, but working it out, and were uncertain, were full of doubts, were complex, messy people like the rest of us. So I think it was, my anger was always at the institutions, where I could feel the blindness that was required to keep such straight lines.
Thank you. I think a lot of us echo those sorts of sentiments. And I would say, be kind and gentle with yourself as you unwork something to then work into something else. I came to Greenbelt when I was 15 in 1990. And there's only grey hair to prove it. And it was such a culture shock coming from a mildly fundamentalist Pentecostal setting. But it really opened me up, and it planted some seeds which have grown and evolved. And so it takes time. But thank you so much for kind of condensing what has been, for some of us, decades-long journeys. Next question, please.
So my conversion experience was surrounded by queerness, love, progressive Christians, and this made a profound difference to me at the time. But I know people in my life and people in the kind of public sphere who have had conversion experiences that appear expressed to me, and maybe I'm not being tolerant enough, as a conservative political act. This is kind of connected to the fabulous first question. Do you have experience of sitting with people who had a completely different conversion experience to yourself? How do you go about speaking with people without delegitimizing that, when there appears such a gulf between the practices and beliefs that you hold?
What do you mean that their conversion felt conservative? Do you mean that's the kind of church they ended up in?
I feel I know quite a few people from childhood, from university and everything, who have chosen faith as an expression of previously held conservative beliefs. Mm-hmm. And we're talking about people getting into orthodoxy, people getting into kind of very, very traditionalist ideas of church. There is, for me, a through line that I've seen from kind of getting into, for example, the alt-right and a lot of internet subcultures, and into certain kind of traditionalist ideas of church. Mm-hmm. And the conversion experience seems to almost manifest that in people. And I'm interested how you've chatted to people who have maybe had that experience, or what advice you would have.
It's really hard, because I think definitely faith or religion is a tool that can be weaponized. So I'm thinking about Russell Brand, that all the abuse allegations, sexual abuse allegations, which have now, I think he's been convicted, I could be wrong, but that he then started talking about being Christian, and it did feel like it was this way of saying, you have to now forgive me. It felt to me cynical. But I say that, and I'm only saying that because, again, I feel like I'm punching up with Russell Brand. Is that what I mean? Yes, I mean that. Whereas, like, I don't think any of us can say whether or not someone's conversion is legitimate. It's a completely personal experience. The book that was my lodestar for writing this book was William James's The Varieties of Religious Experience. Woo. Who woot? Oh, you, obviously. it's an extraordinary book by a psychologist, turn of the century, writing it in 1900, as a series of lectures. And he talks about all these different forms of religious experiences that people have. And what's so beautiful about this book is it's so generous. He takes every single religious experience as seriously as every other. Some of them are people who have loads and loads of mental health problems. Some of them are people who, yeah, have an unexpected conversion and then go back to their lives as they were before. And I think the difficulty is that we just have to take people at face value, as you hope your friends do about your conversion. That actually, tell you what's useful. William James says that with a conversion, we know it, or sorry, with a religious experience, we know it not by its roots, but by its fruits. So where does it lead you next? And perhaps that's a useful thing to think about if talking to friends. And certainly I thought that I met people who ended up in churches that were really conservative. But I also saw that these are people who maybe had mental health issues or difficulties. And the NHS, because it's struggling so much, these people had fallen through the gaps. And these churches that sure had some messaging that I find difficult also protected this person and helped him through this crisis. So there's negatives and positives in all these things. And I think, yeah, again, it's like, it's kind of beautiful to think maybe you've had a conversion and they've had a conversion, meaning you're in the same faith. There must be some things that you kind of connect on through that. But also it is really difficult when people use religion as a way of saying, my views that are hostile towards minorities should be legitimized. That is unforgivable, I think.
Right. Thank you. So I'd like to get the next two questions, actually. Is that all right? So if you could do yours, and then the young lady behind, if you could do yours, please. Thank you.
Hi, I'm just wondering, as someone that's in their mid-20s, what was the kind of main reoccurring reason in your research that people actually came to faith in their 20s, or like young people?
Oh, yeah.
Right, thank you. Oh, yeah, could I get the other one as well?
Oh, sorry. Yeah.
Hello, we were just wondering, how do you practice your faith day to day? And does that involve going to church?
Brilliant. Yeah. Thank you. Okay. Right, if you could respond
to
both.
Thank you. Okay, so I guess I found that, as ever, there's so many different kinds of young people. I think something I noticed is that at the moment we feel, again, I'm going to speak in a generalized way, which I know doesn't include everyone, but we're in a period where everyone does feel quite atomized. Our lives feel fragmented by the fact that we have, our relationship with technology feels fraught. Young people are moving from flat to flat every single year because mostly, like, you know, we can't afford housing. This feeling of like there being a lack of community. I think then churches provide both this sacred space and this sense of intergenerational community that maybe lots of young people are lacking. So that's one thing I definitely found. I really do think that in moments of like horrendous political crisis, like thinking again about the genocide, thinking about the climate crisis, this sense of saying, hope in the making, I need spaces in which I can feel hopeful. Suddenly prayer might become something that becomes useful to a person in that way. I also think it's a big thing that, and again, I think there are lots of young people here who were brought up within churches, but a lot of the people I met, their parents didn't have any background in religion. And so no longer was faith being something that was pushed on them. And therefore, to rebel actually felt like maybe I'm going to look at something spiritual. I'm actually not seeing anything spiritual at home. I might go and look for this myself in other places. But so many different reasons, like a lot of loneliness, a sense that we all have this, like we're all beings of longing who are like, my relationships have so much meaning in them. There's so much beauty to be found. I want to be rooted to something historical that talks about that. All these mystic, any bit of poetry from like predating like 1930s, it often will have some kind of religious element, some kind of beauty to it that speaks to this idea of divinity or something profound, something beyond us. And I think people then thinking, hang on, maybe the new atheists weren't right, that you can just get rid of all of religion and say it's too marred by its darknesses, and actually saying these are spaces in which I might be able to access this sense of community, meaning, transcendence still. I think that we feel, like a lot of young people feel that. So maybe that's one. There's so many different answers. Yeah. Every young person is different. That's what was so exciting about the research.
What about you? How do you practice your faith?
For a while I was quite consistent of going to this really beautiful Anglican church in Holloway near where I live. And it's a really special place. And still, again, this intergenerational thing, one of the priests there, the associate priest, sometimes just calls me up for a pastoral call. And my friend's like, who's that? And I was like, ask my priest. And that feels really beautiful to me, to get this bit of church that I just didn't really know existed. When I was going to that church, that was sort of where I learned how to pray, because I really liked the quick silent moments where you get to go and light a candle. And I started to think about what the act of prayer, a personal prayer, could be, one that was sort of extemporized. I've been way less good at going to that church. I think I've actually found the book coming out and talking about Christianity so much completely overwhelming, if I'm totally honest with you, because suddenly it's like I have to speak about Christianity all the time and I'm a complete novice. And I don't necessarily know for sure where I stand on it. But the weird thing about a book is you have to come to some kind of conclusion. And my conclusion is definitely a bit up in the air, but I think I still was like nervous about the idea of having to stick somewhere. Recently, I go to the palace. For every Palestine protest or trans rights protest, I often go with the Quaker block at the moment, because I really like the way that they do a meeting for worship first and that silence. So recently I've started going back to Quaker meetings, and I find that whereas when I first started going, the silence, I could only hear my own annoying thoughts within the silence. And now I go back there and I have again a bit more of this sense of what I'm doing in that space, what the history of the Quakers were, the Civil War, with George Fox, like where that silence comes from, what the inner light might mean. And so I've actually really enjoyed recently been going back to Quaker meetings a bit. But I think the beautiful thing about doing this research is suddenly churches don't feel like scary, alienating places. I feel like I can kind of enter into a lot of them. Or being here, I came here 2 years ago for research, didn't make it into the book, but I can walk through Christian spaces with so much more of a sense of like how all the beauty that's in it and kind of how to operate in it. So hopefully I'm on the beginning of some long and very twisty path through faith. I'm not really sure.
That's brilliant. Thank you. So I think, can we stay in the venue for a little bit after this finishes if people want to continue to ask questions?
I think okay. I'm going across for 5 to go and sign books. So also, yeah, if you want to come and chat to me, I'd love to chat
brilliant.
To people.
So we're coming towards the end. So you with your burning questions, please do stick around for a bit, and then Lamorna's going to be book signing, because remember, put your hands up, everybody. Oh, yeah. Yeah, you know where I'm going, don't you? Keep your hand up if you're going to go get a book bought and get it signed. Okay, so those of you with questions, we're not going to have your questions now, but if you'd like to come and talk to us at the end, that would be absolutely fine. But I've asked Lamorna, there's so many wonderful inspirations, and so I've asked her to share a poem that means something to her as we begin to conclude our time together and our conversation.
Thank you. Thank you so much. They were all such beautiful questions. I kind of knew that coming here I'd get like the best questions I've had, because obviously this is stuff that you all think about all the time. So I'm really grateful. It's really helpful for me, and your questions are wonderful. Thank you so much.
And we.
Brilliant. So Azra, I was like, do you have a poem that you've written? And I was like, I am not brave enough to read one of my crappy poems. And then I was going to read this poem I really love about capybaras, but it felt like I was just like being like purposefully obtuse by reading something that had nothing to do with anything. So instead, I changed my mind, and I'm going to read my favorite Gerard Manley Hopkins poem. This is a poem that I learned off by heart when I was on the island of Iona, because there was a talent show, but I can't remember it anymore, unfortunately, so I'm going to have to read it from the text. It's from his the poems that he wrote while he was in St. Bino's. So having been in London, he suddenly was in near Snowdon in the most beautiful landscape and had these miraculous encounters with God. And he was gay, we're almost like certain that Gerard Manley Hopkins was gay, and he had to repress his sexuality. But what fascinated him most in nature was always strangeness and complexity and anything that felt like heterogeneous. So this is a poem called Pied Beauty. Glory be to God for dappled things, for skies of couple colour as a brinded cow, for rose moles all in stipple upon trout that swim, fresh fire coal, chestnut falls, finches' wings, landscape plotted and pieced, fold, fallow and plough, and all trades, their gear and tackle and trim. All things counter, original, spare, strange. Whatever is fickle, freckled, who knows how, with swift, slow, sweet, sour, a dazzle dim, he fathers forth, whose beauty is past change, praise him.
Ramona Ash, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for listening to this recorded talk. Explore our full Greenbelt Festival Talks archive with almost 20 years of recorded talks and podcasts for free at greenbelt.org.uk/talks.